a security memo was sent out in December 1954 that recommended that punch bowls at office parties not be spiked.
Hi, I'm Akshi.
And I'm Shayna, and you're listening to Unpacking the Eerie,
a podcast that explores the intersections of our dark and morbid curiosities through a social justice lens.
You're welcome.
Just a brief content warning. This episode will contain mentions of violence, torture, anti-Black racism, and drugs.
Hello.
It was kind of harmonized.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to part two of our MKUltra series.
Yeah.
We have some announcements to make before we jump back in.
Mm-hmm. Merch is coming soon.
Merch is coming very soon. Yes, they're all designed.
Very, very soon.
We just ordered them first to make sure.
It's working out.
Yeah.
And yeah, so keep an eye out.
Mm-hmm. And Patreon patrons are going to have a discount on all items. So
yay!
If you want to become a patron,
not already.
Please join us. Speaking of Patreon, I wanted to share our Spring 2022 Ghosty Giver beneficiary. So we're donating to Sister Song, a reproductive justice org. They're based in Georgia, and they define reproductive justice as the human right to maintain personal bodily autonomy, to have children, not have children, and parent the children we have in safe, sustainable communities. As our episodes routinely cover stories that highlight the violation of marginalized bodies and explorations of community safety, reproductive justice is a guiding principle of ours. Given the real-time onslaught of gun violence, hate violence, and draconian moves to restrict reproductive care, our next Ghosty Giver funds will be directed towards Sister Song's efforts to build an effective network of individuals and organizations to improve institutional policies and systems that impact the reproductive lives of marginalized communities. So thank you so much to our Ghosty Givers for making that possible, as per usual. And if you would like to help us continue to make these contributions and expand the amount we're able to give, I invite you to join the Ghosty Giver tier. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Also, I just want to say, like, if you're someone with financial privilege.
Yes.
And or a white person, and you're listening to this and you're enjoying the content and you're learning a lot of stuff, our first Patreon tier is $2 a month. So.
Yeah. And you know, there's a, this concept of an energy exchange. So if you're learning a lot but not contributing anything back, it's kind of imbalanced. But just saying, there's small ways to balance that out.
That's true. I mean, I also want to validate, like, it's not just about money, right? Like, there's, like, sharing and
yes, exactly
citing where you learned information from.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, energy exchange is not just about money. But if you have financial privilege and, you know, have the privilege of benefiting from generational wealth,
mm-hmm.
then you have the capacity to use your money as part of that energy exchange more than others do.
Mm-hmm,
and if you don't, then yeah, there's other ways that you can, you know, support through sharing and chatting about it with your friends and that kind of thing.
Yeah, totally. And I guess one last thing, if, you know, you're an occasional listener or if this is your first time, just in general, we collect all of our beneficiaries and we save them on the website. So if you're looking for a place to give your money to and you're not really sure where to direct mm-hmm. it because there's so much going on,
mm-hmm.
All of those places are chosen really intentionally, and I
yes.
encourage you to support their work. Anywho's.
So we're back to talking about MK Ultra today.
Mm-hmm.
So last time we kind of just gave you a lot of context on, like, what was going on in the world when this project began.
Mm-hmm.
And today we're going to kind of go more deeply into what was going on there. Are you ready?
I think so. And also, if, like, you know, you're starting here, don't start here.
Yes.
Go to part one.
Yes.
And then come back.
Yeah, or else you might be a little confused. So, yes. So, at the end of the last episode, I gave a very general, brief overview of the experiments that happened. To remind you, MK Ultra was started in April of 1953, and it had over 149 known sub-projects across 80 different institutions, universities, prisons, and hospitals. There was a book that was written by Stephen Kinzer that we mentioned in the last episode. And in his book, he gives a list of more than 30 universities, institutions, and hospitals, many of which were actually very, you know, quote unquote, renowned in America, that received funding to carry out our poisoner-in-chief, Sidney Gottlieb's program. So today, I'm going to kind of go a little deeper into some of these sub-projects. As mentioned last time, CIA officials have admitted that the first people that were targeted were vulnerable groups, quote, those who could not fight back. An example, Sub-Project 3 happened in New York, and it was there was a CIA agent was recruited to go around Greenwich Village posing as a merchant seaman or a bohemian artist. And he lured drug users and, quote, petty criminals and others who, quote, could be relied on not to complain about what happened to them, pretty much preying on the vulnerable and traumatized. I found this article that was actually just very recently published in the Journal of Medical Ethics. It was published last year by authors Dana Strauss, Sarah de La Salle, Jordan Sloshower, and Monica T. Williams, all researchers at the University of Ottawa. This article was titled Research Abuses Against People of Color and Other Vulnerable Groups in Early Psychedelic Research. And they pretty much examined and looked at early psychedelic research that was conducted in the U.S. between 1950 and 1980 to understand to what extent people of color and other vulnerable groups were exploited during this first wave of psychedelic research. So a lot of this article actually talks about experiments that were conducted through Project MKUltra. So a lot of the victims of MKUltra in the U.S. were Black Americans, mostly because they were drawn from prisons, hospitals, and mental health facilities, and a large proportion of the people at these facilities were Black Americans. So there was this research center in Lexington, Kentucky, known as the Addiction Research Center. It was actually the National Institute of Mental Health's official addiction research center. It was also known as the Narcotic Farm. It was a site that functioned both as a prison and a research center. And here they tested LSD and 800 other psychoactive drugs on a population that was almost exclusively Black. The facility marketed itself as a hybrid hospital and addiction science lab that was, quote, making waves in the drug rehabilitation world. Whereas in practice, it was really more functioned like a prison. The director of research there, his name was Dr. Harris Isbell, and he was born June 7th, 1910, a Gemini. When I went to his Wikipedia page, it really doesn't paint him out to be like a horrible person or anything close to that. He was actually awarded a U.S. Public Health Service Meritorious in 1962. He was described by the Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy as an outstanding investigator whose work in clinical pharmacology has exerted far-reaching influences on medical practice. Most of his research was investigating aspects of physical dependence as it relates to drugs, but his later work was part of the MKUltra project. And the research that was conducted through MKUltra project by Dr. Harris Isbell resulted in
several papers being published in academic journals, such as the Journal of Pharmacology and Experimental Therapeutics, Psychopharmacologia, and AMA Archives of Neurology and Psychiatry. There's over 125 publications, including ones that talk about the benefits of Narcan and methadone to alleviate opiate symptoms. So this dude actually had a pretty liberal view when it came to drug policy because of the research that he did on drugs. He is quoted to have said that the drug laws of the time in the 1970s were excessively rigid and extremely punitive. So that's this doctor, right? As part of the MKUltra project, Isbell's patients were fed increasing doses of LSD. As we noted last time, LSD is a substance that you build tolerance to really quickly, so they just kept giving higher and higher doses, some of them for days and weeks on end.
Oh my God.
Yeah. In some of these studies, the Black patients were given more than two times the amount of LSD as white patients. Mm. The paper that I mentioned earlier that came out last year observed that white participants endured only 8 days of LSD administration, while Black participants endured chronic administration for up to 85 days. So there was a clear difference in which the Black patients were treated.
Yeah.
Compared to the white patients.
85 days. What does that do to you?
Yeah. 3 months straight. I don't know. And these are people who already have, like, substance use disorders.
Yeah.
Isbell stated that in one experiment, he gave 7 Black patients daily doses of LSD, which he would double, triple, or quadruple to keep them from building a tolerance, all without their knowledge. This dude has been awarded a U.S. Public Health Service meritorious.
I can't.
Like, what the fuck, you know?
Yeah.
There's a documentation that one patient was given LSD for 174 days straight. What in increasingly higher doses.
Okay, I'm just thinking about, remember Orly Cow?
Yes.
And I mean, I don't remember exactly how long she was in there, but I feel like it was very brief not this intensive. Like LSD was like an occasional thing.
Yeah.
And they were able to like reduce her back to a childlike state.
Yeah.
And she never recovered.
Yeah.
So what the fuck happened to these people?
Yeah, there isn't a record of it, so.
Oh my God, I hate it here.
He also told the Senate subcommittee when they were investigating MKUltra that the ethical codes were not so highly developed at the time, and there was a great need to know in order to protect the public in assessing the potential use of narcotics. So it was very necessary, and I personally think that we did a very excellent job. No one cares about your personal opinion, dude. So,
excellent job, he
says. Yeah. One really fucked up thing about what was happening at this addiction research center is that Black research participants who were there because they were incarcerated on drug charges were given heroin or their drugs of choice as payment for participation that they could redeem immediately or save for later.
What the fuck?
So coercive.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
This is reminding me a lot of like how people get like stuck in survival sex work.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And abusive relationships, too.
Uh-huh.
I definitely, like, have seen that before also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is at a place that was the National Institute of Mental Health's Addiction Research Center that was known to be somewhere that was, like, making waves in drug rehabilitation. Which is similar to the place that you talked about with Dr. Ewan Cameron.
Totally. I mean, he was really world-renowned.
Yeah.
People thought he was, like, amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, people thought this dude was amazing too. Nothing happened to him. I mean, he just continued to live his life and then he passed away. Classic. So Dominic Streatfeild, author of the book Brainwash, The Secret History of Mind Control, wrote,
about the Addiction Research Center. The CIA needed a place to test dangerous and possibly addictive drugs. Isbell had a large number of drug users in no position to complain. He referred to these participants as, quote, volunteers.
What the fuck?
Yeah, yeah. The people who signed up for his drug trials were never actually told which narcotics they've been given and what their potential effects were. They were compensated in heroin and morphine, the same drugs for which they were supposedly receiving addiction treatment. So unethical in so many different ways, you know, and so harmful. So harmful. Like, I don't know. We don't know what happened to these people. We don't know.
Well, no stories, nothing. Just lost?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's really fucked up.
Yeah.
I didn't hear any of this in any of my research on MKUltra at all.
Yeah.
No podcasts, no articles, nothing.
Yeah. I mean, this... I read this in the research paper that came out last year.
Oh my god.
Which was written by those researchers in Ottawa. I actually have met one of them.
Really?
Monica T. Williams. She actually does a lot of research as it relates to the therapeutic use of psychedelics and people of color. And also has written a lot of research papers on the exclusion of people of color from psychedelic research, which... put a pin in that. I'll come back to it later.
And it reminds me of, this is a loose connection. I don't think it's loose. I just don't know if it'll be clear as it is in my head. But like, I feel like there's a lot of benefits to psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, right? And I just feel like most of the people who are willing and wanting to try it are white people.
Yeah. And which I'll talk about it later. Yeah, yeah, I'm going to talk about that later.
Because like,
because there is a resistance from people of color to want to even be part of this research.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because, you know, its history is, like, really, really fucked up.
Thing with palliative care.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I listened to this whole talk on... Someone came to the UW.
Yeah.
Did research around, like... it was, like, in the intersections of, like, economics and social work was his, like, PhD stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he did work around, like, palliative care and how end-of-life care has been commodified and part of the medical-industrial complex when initially it wasn't intended to do that. But in order to make it more commonplace in hospitals, that's the direction that they took it. But, you know, research shows that palliative care extends your life, increases quality of life, all this shit. And overwhelmingly, when they asked, like, people of color versus white people how willing they were to try, the numbers were just so vastly different. Like, white people were super down to try it out, and like BIPOC communities were extremely resistant. And it makes sense because usually palliative care is offered to white people as a way to be like, as an alternative to aggressive cancer treatment. And palliative care is like then offered to like BIPOC communities as like an option before other things have been exhausted.
Mm.
And so the problem of too much care is only like a thing for white people.
Yeah.
So.
Well, also there's just like such a strong history of like trauma from medical systems in specifically Black communities. So it makes sense that there is a lack of trust when it comes to these like, ooh, like new modalities or like, you know, things that are seen to be maybe like really helpful, because the history of medical research is in the trauma of their communities.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that's what they, like, when they did the qualitative stuff, like, that was the sentiment of, like, what I'm hearing from that is you're giving up on me.
Yeah.
And you're not giving me access to the medication that I need.
Sure, sure.
So it's just, like, really, yeah.
Yeah. Well, back to this. Subproject 47 was at the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, and the research there was conducted by Carl Pfeiffer, who was at Emory University at the time. He administered LSD to 20 incarcerated folks at Atlanta Federal Penitentiary nearly every day for over a year. 15 months, to be exact. Interestingly,
there was a Boston mobster who was a prisoner at this penitentiary at the time, Whitey Bueller. He was a white person. Which is probably why his name was Whitey Bueller. But he was reportedly given... And also, I just find it interesting that there's, like, specific stories about white people, but we don't have any specific stories about the probably hundreds of black folks that were, you know...
Like, most impacted?
Yeah. But Whitey Bueller was reportedly given 50 doses of LSD along with a handful of other incarcerated folks. And they were all told that they were helping to find a cure for schizophrenia. They, again, weren't told what they were being injected with. Before Bueller passed away, he wrote about the experience and he said, quote, "The room would change shape, hours of paranoia and feeling violent. Guys turning into skeletons in front of me. I saw a camera change to the head of a dog. I felt like I was going insane."
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like, just imagine linking back to what we were talking about, like, LSD and how it works last time, and think about what it would be like to be an incarcerated person doing that, being dosed with it, not knowing what it is, like, in a prison setting.
Can't imagine.
In the 50s.
Can't imagine. Yeah. I mean, set and setting,
yeah,
as we've learned, is very important. Yeah.
So, Louisiana State Penitentiary. 1955, the CIA made a deal with Dr. Robert Heath at Tulane University, who is a chair of psychology. Using CIA funds, him and his assistant, Harry Bailey, conducted non-consensual experiments on, again, black incarcerated folks, giving them LSD and bulbocapnine, which is a drug that induces catatonia or stupor when it's given in high doses.
What the fuck?
The purpose of this was that the CIA wanted to learn whether certain drugs would result in loss of speech, loss of sensitivity to pain, loss of memory, loss of willpower, and increased toxicity in persons with weak type central nervous system. So, again, trying to just, like, induce childlike states in people.
I mean, goddamn. Like, just between this and, like, forced sterilization and all this shit.
This is a really fucked up quote, but Bailey, who is the assistant, reportedly later stated, as thinking about the experiments and who they did it on,
yeah,
that it had been cheaper to use, and he uses the N-word to describe them, cheaper to use than cats because they were everywhere and cheap experimental
what
animals.
What the fuck? What the actual fuck?
Yeah.
Oh my God. It's, I mean, I shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
But I am continuously just, yeah, like, so disgusted.
Yeah, maybe it's not surprise, but it's more just, like, anger, you know, of, like, the severe dehumanization of people for what purpose?
And the how it was so normal for him,
yeah,
to say that.
Yeah.
He didn't feel
and
anything
he didn't
about
think
it.
There was anything wrong with it. And then this other dude was just like, "We did an excellent job." It was like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Oh my
you
God.
Like
they
really
live in another fucking planet.
You traumatized all of these people and like you have so much like of an ego and like narcissism that you think that you're like some kind of god.
Something's wrong with them.
Yeah.
Something's wrong with all of them.
All of these people.
What
they
the
really
fuck?
Think that they are god and that they can do whatever the fuck they want.
You know what? Who are your ancestors? I bet you they,
yeah,
were some fucked up shit.
Yeah.
There's no way people are just like this. You,
yeah,
inherit that shit. You inherit it. You inherit the entitlement. You're enabled,
yeah,
by like this, like your environments. I'm just thinking about like so many of the things that we've covered.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah.
Like Lake Lanier.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
The list is like really long.
Yeah. Goes on and on.
What the fuck?
Really, really fucked. So I have a little more to say about stuff that I learned from this specific research article, which is like, you know, thanks to all these authors for this research article, for like really digging deep and bringing all of this to light in 2021, you know, thank you. So there was another operation. It was called Operation Third Chance, which was drug experiments that were actually primarily conducted against unknowing Europeans. But the only American who was dosed with LSD in these experiments was James Thornwell, the only black soldier at his station in France.
Oh my God.
So I actually have his specific story. It's like one of the only specific stories that I have that comes from him directly.
Okay.
So he was accused of stealing classified documents and was subjected for more than 3 months to an interrogation during which he was physically abused, received death threats, degraded by streams of verbal abuse, including racial slurs and accusations of sexual impropriety by members of the Army Counterintelligence Corps. According to his legal complaint that he made after this. After 99 days of this, so over 3 months, a team from Operation Third Chance showed up and, without his consent, gave Thornwell LSD and then continued humiliation and, like, torment. The Army notes that Thornwell was described to have an extreme paranoid reaction.
Okay.
No shit. Because he didn't know that he had been dosed with LSD and was also completely unfamiliar with what it was, since it wasn't really a well-known thing at the time. He thought he was losing his mind.
Yeah.
Thornwell's army abusers told him they had the power to extend this state indefinitely, even to a permanent condition of insanity. He fainted from, like, this constant trauma, and he was finally sent home after this. And then after this, an officer on the intelligence team of the Army concluded they had satisfactory evidence of the subject's claims of innocence. So they supposedly did all of this to him because he was, quote, accused of stealing classified documents. And then at the end of it, they said, oh, well, we don't think he actually did that. 4 months later, Thornwell was given a general, though not honorable, discharge from the Army.
Wow.
How many
fuckers got honorably discharged?
Yeah.
From the military after killing hella people.
Yeah. And I mean, we've talked about, I think we talked about in the Queen Mary episode, mm-hmm. about black soldiers who are, like, part of the Army and the kind of racism they faced. And that's like, you know, after they decided to join the Army, after everything that has happened to them, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. It took Thornwell 16 years before he learned what actually had happened to him, and he filed a lawsuit in 1979 stating that the experience turned him into isolated social and emotional cripple. He described a life of headaches, depression, and nightmares. During the trial, evaluating psychiatrists unanimously concluded he suffered from severe psychiatric disorders. In 1980, Congress publicly apologized to Thornwell and granted him a $625,000 payment. 4 years later, he drowned after a suspected epileptic seizure. That's one story. And that's the only specific story I could find. But, like, this is just, like, so fucked up.
I don't understand.
You do understand.
I do understand, but I don't understand.
Yeah. I don't understand, because you must be so fucked up in the head to be able to do these things and then still not think that you did anything wrong, you know?
Yeah, how do you sleep at night?
They clearly slept fine and then just, like, you know, died by natural causes, all of these fucking doctors.
I hate that. Did you ever watch that? It was like in 2020, around the time of the uprisings, and there's this video that Kimberly Jones released, and she said, like, you know, you're really lucky that black folks are just looking for justice when they could be looking for revenge.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they're lucky that a lot of people, like, the whole world is now looking for revenge against white people, because y'all are really outnumbered there.
I mean, that's what they're scared of, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, like, you know, that's the whole thing behind trying to create conflict between marginalized groups so that we don't band together in order to, like, you know, fight our real enemies. That's white supremacy.
Right. Yeah. And great replacement theory makes a lot of sense in this context, just because I feel like their only version of just, the Great Replacement Theory is a white supremacist theory that Jewish people are in collusion with like communities of color and that people are conspiring to wipe out the white race.
Oh, got it.
And so I think like a lot of the anti-abortion people, a lot of them have like undertones of this Great Replacement Theory. And people theorize that, like, part of this whole thing is not just about, you know, obviously, like, criminalizing women and people you perceive to be women's bodies, but also to make more space to keep, to keep producing white people as people are slowly not having as many children anymore.
Yeah.
So it's all fucked up, but, like, you know, if you're operating under the premise that people are going to seek justice like you do, like in your retributive way, then it would make sense that you assume people are going to enact revenge. Because on some level, you know that if you were on the other end, you would think that that's what people deserve.
Before I move on to talking a little bit about other kinds of experiments that happened under MKUltra, I'm just going to end this part with a quote by Diana Strauss, who's a PhD candidate in psychology at the University of Ottawa. She says, in the 1950s and 60s, researchers weren't thinking about the need to take extra precautions with vulnerable populations. Whether or not those researchers were explicitly targeting Black Americans, they drew their participants most frequently from prisons where Black Americans were overrepresented because of racism and arrest charges, incarceration, and sentencing. But we also know, based on this one quote that that dude said, that they truly knew what the fuck they were doing, you know? And it was intentional. So, fucked. Super fucked. Part of the experiments that were happening under MKUltra, I couldn't find a lot of specifics about this, but were happening with students at universities. One thing that I found was that the Boston Psychopathic Hospital paid hundreds of students from Emerson, Harvard, and MIT $15 to $20 each to drink a vial of liquid that might induce an altered state. So we can just see the difference in which these like students are like treated. They're like, oh, you're a paid research study, and like, we're going to inform you that this might, you know, change the way you perceive your reality.
Yeah.
And they're agreeing to be part of this.
Well, these are young people with access to...
Still though, these students, which included, you know, people of all genders, were asked to drink a tall glass of water, which was said to have a mind-altering drug added to it. And then they participated for 10 to 12 hours in various psychological tests. They were told that they were giving LSD and that they would have variable reactions. It was later found, though, that none of the people that were involved in the experiments, so the people conducting them, had any kind of proper training or understanding on how to guide the participants. And several people had really negative reactions to it. And one person actually hanged herself in a clinic bathroom. I couldn't find any more details about that. It was just kind of like mentioned, and it's in a book. But experiments like this also happened at the University of Maryland and George Washington University, Georgetown University, Stanford, Columbia, and Harvard. I just didn't dig deep into what those experiments actually looked like, but still super irresponsible, even though people were given informed consent. Interestingly, MKUltra's experiments also included dosing CIA agents with LSD because they just wild and really just not even do it. Like, they're just clearly not even thinking about it. So it started slowly with agents self-administering LSD and then taking notes on how this went. Then once they were like, okay, we kind of get what this was going to be like, they agreed to dose each other unexpectedly, anytime and anywhere. And after a dosing happened, agents were given the rest of the day off. And then later on, they started dosing other people in the CIA who had never even tried it and hadn't agreed to being dosed unexpectedly. Martin Lee, who's the author of Acid Dreams, a book about the history of LSD in the CIA, says, "Surprise acid trips became something of an occupational hazard among CIA operatives."
No shit. They're really just out here being wild as fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
In what world?
Yeah, and they have so much money and so much power. And
and they're just acting so irresponsibly, and truly nothing has changed.
You know, it makes sense that, I mean, I'm going to get into this later about conspiracy theories, but this whole thing sounds like a fucking conspiracy theory. And they did that shit.
Yeah, this is real. This is not a conspiracy theory. Like, all of these things are, like, verified information by people who were, like, in the CIA and, you know.
And 20,000 documents that they forgot to burn.
Yeah. Because they're bad at organizing themselves. Clearly. Obviously, not everyone at the CIA was down for this shit.
Sure.
Because who the fuck, you know. Yeah, it was a special kind of person to be down for this shit. Mm-hmm. There was a rumor that circulated that there were plans to use a party as the scene of a mass dosing. And after this rumor was spread, a security memo was sent out in December 1954 that recommended that punch bowls at office parties not be spiked. And then one employee, like, would bring his own wine, which he guarded to office functions because he was, like, nervous of being dosed.
What the fuck?
Yeah. In one incident of this, an agent ran out into the street after being dosed unexpectedly with LSD, and apparently each time a car passed, he would huddle and was terribly frightened. A colleague was explaining the story, and every car seemed to be a monster out to kill him. Yeah.
I'm just like, how many experiments need to happen? You know what it does.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think now is a good time to pass to you to tell us about how MK Ultra kind of fizzled out.
Okay. Well, some people think it didn't, but I'll get into that later. Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. So, we're going to talk about a man named Frank Olson. This information is pulled by a Guardian article written by good old Stephen Kinzer, who clearly spent a lot of time hyperfixating on this whole thing.
True.
Yeah. So Frank Olson was one of the first scientists assigned to the secret U.S. biological warfare laboratories at Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland during the Second World War. And there he began working with a handful of colleagues who would accompany him throughout his career. One of them was Harold Abramson. Others included ex-Nazi scientists who had been brought to work on secret missions in the U.S., I think, via Operation Paperclip. Yes. So for a time, they worked on aerosol technologies, ways to spray germs or other toxins on enemies and defend against such attacks to the U.S. And then later, Olson met with U.S. intelligence officers who had experimented with quote-unquote truth drugs in Europe, which is, you know, what we've been talking about. So this was the period when the senior army and CIA were becoming really alarmed when they thought that the Soviets were getting mind control drugs and mind control tactics and using it against U.S. soldiers. So this, like, fear led to the creation of the Special Operations Division, and then rumors about its work spread through offices and labs. Olson learned about it over an evening game of cards with a colleague, John Schwab, who he had been named the division's first chief. And so Schwab invited him to join. Olson accepted. And less than a year later, Olson succeeded Schwab as the chief of the Special Operations Division. There, Olson's specialty was, quote-unquote, the airborne distribution of biological germs. And there was a study that said Dr. Olson had developed a range of lethal aerosols in handy-sized containers. Yeah, they were disguised as shaving cream and insect repellents. They contained a variety of poisonous chemicals, one of them being anthrax. Yes, the birthplace of anthrax.
Further weapons he was working on included a cigarette lighter, which gave out an almost instant lethal gas, a lipstick that would kill on contact with skin, and a neat pocket spray for asthma sufferers that induced pneumonia.
Oh my god, that's wild.
This man was really out here, and his whole job was to figure out how to kill people.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, by the time Olson stepped down as the chief of the Special Operations Division in early 1953, he was complaining that the pressure of the job aggravated his ulcers, and then he joined the CIA.
It's like, oh, I'm too stressed out.
I'm too stressed out. I'm gonna join the CIA. All of this murder stuff, it's not sitting well with me.
Yeah.
It's upsetting my tummy. Okay. So in his lab at Fort Detrick, Olson directed experiments that involved gassing or poisoning laboratory animals. I don't know how much he's shifting from his original job, as you'll come to see.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So this article says these experiences disturbed him.
I mean, you know, he's clearly fucked up, but is the first person to be like, oh, this is bothering me.
That's true.
Because everyone else is like, we're doing a great job.
Oh, the bar's in a weird place.
Yeah.
He's like,
Yeah. He's like, this hurts my tummy.
Yes. His son, Eric, recalled that he'd come to work in the morning and see piles of dead monkeys. And then he goes, that messes with you. He wasn't the right guy for that.
Clearly not.
It's just wild that there's so many guys who would have been
fine for that. Fine with it.
Yeah. I mean, they did much worse. Olson also saw human beings suffer. Although not a torturer himself, he observed and monitored torture sessions in several countries. Another study said that in CIA safe houses in Germany, Olson witnessed horrific, brutal interrogations on a regular basis. Detainees who were deemed expendable, quote-unquote suspected spies or moles, security leaks, etc., were literally interrogated to death in experimental methods combining drugs, hypnosis, and torture to attempt to master brainwashing techniques and memory erasing.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. As Thanksgiving approached in 1953... Olson received an invitation to gather on Wednesday, November 18th, for a retreat at a cabin in Deep Creek Lake, Western Maryland. This retreat was one in a series that Sidney Gottlieb convened every few months. They just went on a retreat, chat about their stuff.
Their experiments.
Yeah. Officially, it was the coming together of two groups. There were four CIA scientists from the technical services staff, the folks who ran MK Ultra, and then the five army scientists from the Special Operations Division of the Chemical Corps, the place that was too fucked up for Olson, apparently.
Yeah.
These are the worst people.
Yeah.
These are literally the worst people.
Oh my god.
On Thursday evening, the group gathered for dinner and then settled back for a round of drinks. Gottlieb's deputy, his last name's Lashbrook, produced a bottle. They got out a bottle of Cointreau and poured glasses for the company. And several, including Olson, they drank it. And then after 20 minutes, Sidney was like, anyone feeling weird? And several said that they were. And then he told them their drinks had been spiked with LSD. Is this a game? This is just a game to him.
Ha ha! Guess what?
This article was the news was not well received.
Oh no shit.
Even in their altered state, the subjects could understand what had been done to them, obviously. And the next morning, Olson was very upset. He went back to Friedrich. And by the time he got home, people said he was a changed man. The next morning, Olson showed up early at Fort Detrick. His boss, Vincent Ruitt, arrived shortly after, and both of them were, like, not doing well.
Was this dude also there?
Yeah.
Okay.
They were just, like,
yeah,
kind of fucked up.
Yeah.
More than 4 days had passed since they had been given LSD without their knowledge. Ruitt later called it the most frightening experience he had ever hoped to have. You know, I don't feel bad for these men.
Yeah. Yeah. Me neither.
I don't.
Yeah.
Olson began pouring out his doubts and fears. Ruitt said that he appeared to be agitated and asked if he would fire him or if he should quit.
Well, I just imagine clearly this man is like, this is not the correct job for him. He's like sensitive. And he's already kind of in a place of like, oh, I feel morally questionable about what I'm doing. And then he gets dosed with LSD and then his all of his moral questions are probably like majorly enhanced and he yes. feels physically so uncomfortable. His stomach ulcers are just like...
Yeah, the stomach ulcers are
yeah,
back.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And then he's just like, oh, I can't do this anymore.
I mean, I don't even know if I call him especially sensitive. Yeah. I just think he has like normal. A basic...
Yeah, he's not a sociopath like everyone else clearly is.
Right, right.
He's not dissociated from emotions. He's got some type of
like moral something in yeah. there, a conscience.
Maybe he's not as sensitive, but he is more sensitive than everyone else present, sure. clearly. Yeah.
His conscience is not muted. It's, yeah. It's present. It's present. Being like, yeah. hey.
Yeah.
This kind of stuff's kind of fucked up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Olson had spent 10 years at Fort Detrick. It's a long time to be yeah. like, this is all fucked up and I'm still working here.
Yeah.
And he had, so he had a lot of information about the Operation Division secrets. He held a lot of like classified info and stuff that obviously they wouldn't want people to know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's working with former Nazi scientists.
Yes.
That's just, that in and of itself, they wouldn't want the public to know.
Right. Yes. During this time, he repeatedly visited Germany and brought home pictures from Heidelberg and Berlin, where U.S. military maintained interrogation centers. And he was one of several special ops division scientists who was in France on the 16th of August in 1951, when an entire French village was mysteriously seized by mass hysteria and violent delirium that afflicted more than 200 residents. And caused several deaths.
Airborne something?
The cause was later determined to be poisoning by ergot. Yes. The fungus from which LSD was derived.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Wow. Damn. They're really out here.
Yes. Okay. So it says that this article says... Perhaps most threatening of all, if U.S. forces did indeed use biological weapons during the Korean War, for which there was circumstantial evidence but no proof, Olson would have known. The prospect that he might reveal any of what he'd seen or done was terrifying to them. Go figure. Mm. Wow. We're just, like, fucking evil. Yeah. The U.S. is so evil, bro.
Yeah. I mean... This is, like, we were talking earlier about just, like, people being able to act with impunity. And the U.S. government forever has just been acts with impunity.
Yeah.
And, I mean, no one ever faces consequences for no. this, really. No. Like, at most, there'll be, like, a settlement and, like, someone pays money for it.
Yeah.
And it really doesn't affect their life any more than that. But it's just really wild how, like, they're out here being so violent and, like... The most creative ways.
Mm-hmm. In the most creative ways. Just yeah. so fucked up.
Yeah. What a waste of time and money. Can you just, like, think about, like, what if this money and time and energy was directed elsewhere?
Yeah.
And that these, like, scientists were, like, focusing on things like, climate change?
Yeah.
Like...
I mean, the whole United States was born out of just continuously putting a lot of ugly creative energy into violence. Fucking with other people. Yeah, yeah. Violence.
Violence.
Domination.
Genocide.
Yeah. Theft. All mm-hmm. the things.
Mm-hmm.
God. So, yeah. So, you know, leading up to the LSD, like... The surprise LSD trip.
Yeah.
He was holding all of this.
Yeah, he's probably like having a trip thinking about all this stuff, like
As he should.
That's the whole point. LSD is out here being like, ha ha, making you face all of your demons.
Yes.
I'm personifying it.
You are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in the spring of 1953, he visited a top secret microbiological research establishment in Portendown, Wiltshire.
Where the heck is that?
Portendown in Wiltshire. I don't know where Wiltshire is.
Wiltshire.
Sounds very English.
Yeah. I think it's actually in the UK.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Wiltshire, there were government scientists studying the effects of sarin and other nerve gases.
Mm. Sarin's scary.
Yeah.
You know about the sarin gas attacks mm-hmm. in Japan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was by a cult. A Hindu cult. Orchestrated by Hindu cult. You should cover that at one point.
We should. Well, arguably, I wonder, like, how much this plays a role in making it accessible
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and, like, on people's radars,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
On May 6th, a volunteer subject, a 20-year-old soldier, was dosed with sarin there, and he began foaming at the mouth, collapsed into convulsions, and died an hour later.
Yeah, that's really poisonous gas.
Yeah. Wow. What did they say to him to make mm-hmm. him be like, I'll do this?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Afterward, Olsen spoke about his discomfort with a psychiatrist who helped direct the research, Williams Sargent. Which, I mean, there's a conflict of interest there. They're, like, directing the research, and now he's, like, what, the psychiatrist that he goes and, like, gets support from?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just, like, his discomfort.
Yeah.
That's it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's like, this dude died. I'm uncomfortable.
I mean, maybe it was more than that, yeah. But this article is just like, he spoke about his discomfort with the whole thing.
Yeah. His tummy is really not okay.
No, his tummy is fucked up. A month later, Olsen was back in Germany, and on that trip, according to a later reconstruction of his travels, he visited a CIA safe house near Stuttgart, where he saw men dying, often in agony, from the weapons that he had made.
I mean, yeah.
So, yeah. Back to the time he was dosed. 5 days later, he's still disoriented. His boss at the Special Ops Division called Sidney Gottlieb to report this. And Gottlieb asked him to bring in Olsen for a little chat. And at their meeting, Gottlieb later testified, Olsen seemed, quote-unquote, confused in certain areas of his thinking. And then he decided Olsen needed to go to New York City and be delivered to a physician who was most intimately tied to MKUltra. His name was Harold Abramson. Alice, Olsen's wife, was told that he had to see the physician who had the equal security clearance so he could talk freely, which is why he had to go there. Because I'm sure she was like, why does he have to go to New York for this physician?
Yeah.
And this article was like, this was partly true. Abramson was not a psychiatrist. He was an MKUltra initiate. Gottlieb knew that Abramson's first loyalty was MKUltra, or as he would have put it, to the security of the United States. That made him the ideal person to probe Olsen. So they really weren't sending him to get care. They were sending him to, like, see where his head was at, how much, you know?
Yeah.
Like, how likely was it that this man was going to drop out and, like, spill everything, basically?
Yeah.
So the next morning, Abramson, Lashbrook, Olsen, they drove back to Manhattan. During the next session, Abramson persuaded Olsen to be hospitalized as a voluntary patient at a sanatorium in Maryland, and Olsen and Lashbrook left. They registered at Statler Hotel, and they were given room 1018A. Over dinner at the Statler, Olsen was telling Lashbrook he was looking forward to his hospitalization. He was talking about his books that he would read, and Lashbrook later said he was almost the Dr. Olsen I knew before the experiment. Both of them went back to the room. Olsen washed his socks in the sink and watched TV for a while and then just went to sleep. At 2:25 a.m., he went out the window.
He died?
He died. They were like, I don't remember who found it first, but apparently there was like, you know, if they found him on the ground.
Outside.
Yeah. Not alive.
Yeah.
And then made two and two together.
Yeah, yeah.
That he had
gone out the window.
Mm-hmm. They would say he jumped out the window, but others would say he was killed. And the night manager said, in all my years at the hotel business, I never encountered a case where someone got up in the middle of the night, ran across a dark room in his underwear, avoiding two beds, and dove through a closed window with the shade and curtains drawn.
Pushed.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
He knew too much, and he was contemplating leaving.
Yeah.
So, after the police left, the night manager returned to the lobby and on a hunch asked the telephone operator if any calls had been made to 1018A, and the operator said yes, and that she had eavesdropped. I was like, wow. Which apparently was not an uncommon practice in an era where hotel phone calls were routed through a switchboard. I mean, fair.
People are friggin' bored.
Yeah, all these operators.
Yeah, they're like, what's
going on? I'm sure they heard some wild shit.
Yeah. I probably would. It's entertaining.
It's true. Someone in the room, 1018A, had called a number on Long Island, which was listed to belong to Dr. Harold Abramson. Who was, quote-unquote, a distinguished physician. You know?
Yep.
He was less well-known for his LSD expertise and one of the CIA's medical people.
Yeah, yeah.
And on the phone, the person said, well, he's gone. And Abramson replied, well, that's too bad. Which is a little weird.
Yep.
It's a little odd. So fast forward, June 1975, Olson's wife actually moves forward with a lawsuit and insists that Frank did not die by suicide. And the White House lawyers offered the Olson family $750,000 in exchange for dropping the lawsuit. And the family accepted. They hesitated a bit, but I think they were figured like, you know, we're not going to win this.
Mm-hmm.
And then Congress passed a special bill to approve the payment. Okay. And then the assumption is that that the case was closed. But Eric, his son, waited another decade after his mother died before taking the next step. They wanted to exhume his father's body. And they did that.
Yeah.
At Linden Hill Cemetery in Frederick, Maryland, on June 2nd, 1994. And a forensic pathologist, James Starrs, spent a month studying Olson's body. And when he finished, he called a news conference. His tests for toxins in the body had turned up nothing. The wound pattern, though, was weird. Stars had found that no glass shards were on his head or neck, and which was what you would expect if he dived out the window.
Yeah.
And most intriguingly, this article says, although Olson had reportedly landed on his back, the skull above his left eye was disfigured.
Like he was, like, hit.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. Yeah. So Starr says, I would venture to say that this hematoma is singular evidence of the possibility that Dr. Olson was struck a stunning blow to the head by some person or instrument prior to his exiting the window of room 1018A. I think Frank Olson was intentionally, deliberately, with malice aforethought, thrown out the window. Yes.
Tracks.
Yeah. Because, like, they really went on a thing where they were like, oh, he took drugs, he lost his mind, he jumped out the window.
Yeah.
It was an accident. Yeah. We had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
So, because his family signed away their right to legal relief when they accepted the compensation in 1975, they couldn't sue the CIA anymore. However, Starr's report and other discoveries really enhanced Eric's suspicion that he was murdered. So he was like, my father was murdered, but he couldn't prove it and he couldn't open up a lawsuit. So he and his brother decided it was finally time to just put his dad's body back. And then on August 8th, 2002. This is such a long time that they had his body out and were like, what, like looking.
Yeah.
Wow. The day before the reburial, he called reporters to his home and announced that he had reached a new conclusion about what had happened to his father. So he says, the death of Frank Olson on the 28th of November, 1953 was a murder, not a suicide. Frank Olson did not die because he was an experimental guinea pig who experienced a bad trip. He died because of concern that he would divulge information concerning a highly classified CIA interrogation program in the early 1950s and concerning the use of biological weapons by the United States in the Korean War.
Wild.
Which,
yeah, that tracks.
That does track.
I mean, you know, this also happened way in the beginning of MK Ultra, because 1953 was when the experiment started.
Yeah.
So
he was like,
yeah.
Just the fact that that could happen, and they were like, let's just keep moving.
Yeah.
Business as usual.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, where was their line? Nowhere.
Nowhere.
Their line was nowhere.
There's no line.
They were like, we're working with Nazis.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Okay, so back to MK Ultra as a whole. No longer in 2002. Back to 1973. Also, can I just say that I'm just like, wow, they exhumed his like father's body, did all that work for like a really long time.
Yeah.
And how many people have family members that had died really unjustly and like nothing ever happens at all?
Yeah. Probably through this these experiments too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, absolutely. We don't even know these stories.
Yeah, they're stories about people who were incarcerated. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure, you know, those documents were all just gone.
Mm-hmm. And like, there's so much information and like spotlight on this man who, you know,
objectively was doing a lot of fucked up shit.
Yes.
Himself, you know?
Someone with a lot of privilege and power.
Yeah.
And someone who for a living created deadly weapons that are now used by, still used.
Yeah. To this day.
To this day. So, 1973, amid a government-wide panic caused by Watergate, the CIA director, Richard Helms, ordered all MKUltra files destroyed.
It's like, uh-oh.
Most of the documents, CIA documents regarding the project were destroyed, which made a full investigation of MKUltra impossible, but some 20,000 documents survived the purge because they were stored incorrectly in a financial records building and were discovered following a FOIA request in 1977. And then these documents were fully investigated during the Senate hearing of 1977. History.com says that throughout the hearings, Congress kept hitting roadblocks. CIA staffers claimed that they quote-unquote couldn't remember details about how many, that they couldn't remember details about many of the human experimentation projects or even the number of people involved. Bullshit.
Yeah.
And then the Congressional Committee investigating the CIA research, chaired by Senator Frank Church, concluded that prior consent was obviously not obtained from any of the subjects. The committee noted that the experiment sponsored by these researchers called into question the decision made by the agencies not to fix guidelines for the experiments. And then following recommendations from the Church Committee, Gerald Ford, who was president at the time, in 1976 issued the first executive order on intelligence activities, which, among other things, prohibited experimentation with drugs on human subjects except with informed consent in writing and witnessed by a disinterested party of each such human subject. And I'm just like, wasn't that discussed during the Nuremberg trials? I'm like,
yeah, bro. Yeah. I mean, just related to that also, MK Ultra experiments with LSD apparently were happening till 1963. Mm. And I think this is, also from history.com. John Vance, who is a member of the CIA Inspector General staff, learned about the project. And though the MK Ultra directors tried to convince the CIA's audit board that the research should continue, the Inspector General insisted the agency follow the new research ethics guidelines and bring all the programs on non-consenting volunteers to an end. So they supposedly ended around that time. And also, they, you know, never actually learned anything through this. So what the heck was the point of everything?
just to torment and torture people and create tons of trauma.
Yes.
I think this is a good place to, I was like, when I was doing this research, I was like thinking about whenever I've taken like research classes on psychology and whenever I have new jobs that are related to psychology research, you always have to do the training that's about like ethics and you always have to like read the freaking Belmont Report, which is like super boring. But Belmont Report was written by the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects of Biomedical and Behavioral Research, and it was created as a result of the National Research Act of 1974, so around this time. And it was actually created as a response to the syphilis research studies.
Oh.
Yeah. But pretty much the Belmont Report has like ethical guidelines about human subjects research that like everyone has to follow these days. When it comes to that, that's very long, but basically they have to like assess the role of a risk benefit, and the benefit must be like more than the risk of participating in the research. They have to have informed consent, which was already there in the Nuremberg trials, which was like years before. The basic ethical principles are respect for persons, which includes informed consent, beneficence, which is risk benefit, and justice. Like, who is going to receive the benefits of this research and bear its burdens? Mm-hmm. Pretty much. So that's what the Belmont Report is about. And that was decided upon and written around the same time.
I mean, this also follows, like, a lot of really wild-ass psych studies. Like,
yeah.
The psych studies that are that we use as, like, foundational, like,
yeah,
examples in psych classes were all pretty fucked up. Like,
yeah.
Pavlov was fucked up. We didn't even learn about how he treated those dogs.
Yeah.
And the only reason we know about learned helplessness is because we, like, shocked the shit out of these dogs.
Yeah. Poor doggos.
Yeah, and then the Stanford prison experiment.
Yeah, Stanford prison experiment.
Stanley Milgram, those people thought that they killed somebody. But the way that people kept going just because some dude in a white coat. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you should go look it up because we don't have time.
No, we don't have time.
But
we don't have time.
It's all fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and then like the wire monkey experiment with Henry Harlow, which we do talk about in, I think, the Certified Freak. Anyways. MKUltra has a handful of conspiracy theories tied to it. One is, I don't really think this is a conspiracy. I think this really did happen. I think Frank Olson was murdered. Mm-hmm. But it's listed as a conspiracy just because there isn't sufficient evidence to prove that somebody pushed him out the window. Minus this whole body exhum thing.
Yeah.
Another conspiracy is that there was a sub-cut project of MKUltra and Project Artichoke called Project Monarch. And the claim is that they used children as guinea pigs for their experiments on mind control. Trigger warning, sexual assault. So the claim is that they were kidnapping traumatized children who were already prone to dissociative identity disorder. That they tortured them, they administered LSD, included sensory deprivation, and in an attempt to split their identities and train them to become different people while suppressing their memory.
Oh, goodness.
So some examples were betas, and betas were trained on the art of seduction, and their whole thing was supposed to be to service world leaders on command.
Disgusting.
Gammas were trained for assassination, omega, suicide missions. Personalities would be triggered by certain words, imagery, or music. So like this
hypnosis kind of.
Yeah, yeah. So this stuff. Conspiracy was mostly came out of a book that was written by Kathy O'Brien, who claims that she was one of these children. It's a pretty outlandish. It's pretty outlandish. Like, there are elements of this where I'm like, I could totally see them doing that shit. If they were willing to do all that other shit, I could see them kidnapping children, doing some weird stuff. And if this sounds familiar, it makes sense because there's so much media that was based off of, like, these conspiracy theories. Like, Stranger Things, I think, was inspired by this. So, Kathy O'Brien wrote a book about this called Transformation of America. And she claims that when she was a kid, she was sexually abused by her father, as well as a network of child pornographers, and that he would sell her pornography to them. And she says that she was forced by the CIA to participate in Project Monarch, which she claims is a subsection of Project MKUltra and Project Artichoke. And so she says that she, when she was under hypnosis, she was able to recall memories of sexual abuse. And then her dad got caught selling the child porn and was allegedly, and she was already allegedly showing signs of a DID. And she says that the government approached him and offered him a deal to take Kathy in, and they'd overlook what he had done. And she says that he was sent to Harvard for a crash course to prepare her for the experiments. And in these experiments, they forced her to relive her abuse and trained her to be quote-unquote sexually enhanced, whatever that means. And this conspiracy also incorporates, like, international pedophile rings, drug barons, Satanists, who allegedly used a form of quote-unquote trauma-based mind control programming to make her a sex slave, is what it says.
Jeez.
So, yeah, this is, like, a wild claim. I'm just like, this is, like, some shit, you know?
Yeah.
And back to the Satanists, they said that there was, like, a mix of, like, trauma-based mind control with satanic rituals. Mm-hmm, like, this is what her story is incorporating.
Yeah, yeah.
And she says that by age 16, which is in 1974, she was sent out to be a sex worker in Black Ops and Pentagon operations to seduce the world's leaders. In her book, she accuses a wide range of prominent people, from American, Canadian, Mexican, and Saudi Arabian government officials to stars of country music, of being a part of Project Monarch to operate sex slave rings and commit child abuse. She has, like, a story about how George Bush and Miguel de la Madrid used holograms to appear in her altered forms, saying that Bush apparently activated a hologram of the lizard-like alien, which provided the illusion of Bush transforming like a chameleon before my eyes. In retrospect, I understand that Bush had been painstakingly careful in positioning our seats in order that the hologram's effectiveness would be maximized.
What the heck?
She also says that Project Monarch caused her to develop multiple personality disorder, or DID, but during an alternate personality episodes, she has photographic recall. Her book, Transformation of America, has been credited as originating one of the most significant and extreme mind control conspiracy theories, and her claim of links between satanic ritual abuse and MKUltra have influenced popular conspiracy culture. And I'm just like, all of this really echoes, like, QAnon, Pizzagate, all of those things that have similar, like, patterns of, like, reptilian people are controlling politicians and our celebrities. And this is all, like, the work of Satan. And there's, like, the same child abuse shit, which is just, like, and I remember, like, during Satanic Panic, that was a similar... Those were similar narratives that were going on and on. And so I think, you know, one of the, like, MK Ultra is not direct, like, can't be directly tied to all the things, but I think is a catalyst for a great deal of, like, cult and conspiracy behaviors and beliefs that have persisted from its inception to now. I wanted to take some time to talk about what DID is, because I think it's wrongfully categorized and shown out in, like, the public. And we talked about it a little bit in the Catherine episode, but we didn't really go into it. And I think the only times we ever hear about dissociative identity disorder are these really extreme situations where, like, I don't know, like this, or where a murder happens, or, you know, what have you.
Well, yeah, and then it's in, like, a lot of movies, too.
Like Split.
Yeah. Memento, I think.
Yeah.
But there is that really amazing video of the person who's an artist with DID, who, like, uses her painting to connect with her different identities.
Yeah, honestly, maybe we can include a link, because it really is amazing. She has, like, I think 6 or 7 personalities, and uses art to to channel through them, and all, like, all of her art pieces are distinctly different. You can tell who's painting, which is really wild. And people, I guess, have told her that she's not technically consistent enough, so they won't take her on as like a, I don't know. I don't know how the art world works.
Yeah, yeah.
So she does her own thing. So the National Alliance for Mental Health characterizes dissociative disorders broadly as an involuntary escape from reality characterized by disconnection between thoughts, identity, consciousness, and memory. It impacts people from all age groups and racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic backgrounds, and isn't limited to any one gender, but generally speaking, women are more diagnosed than men. That could be for a variety of reasons, which I don't need to go down that rabbit hole, but
yeah.
So, like, dissociative experiences, depersonalization experiences are really common. Up to 75% of people experience at least one in their lifetimes, but around 2% meet the full criteria for chronic episodes. Usually, this is a response to trauma. The common traumas that they are listing here is abuse or military combat. And it's a way your body responds to protect yourself, to keep your memories under control. And then continuous stressful situations can exacerbate the symptoms, and it can impact your day-to-day living. So there are three types of dissociative disorders that are defined in the DSM. There's dissociative amnesia, which is difficulty remembering important information, or, like, sometimes people will, like, experience really traumatic events and have no memory of it. And it's, like, your body's way of protecting you because it's too hard to integrate. There's depersonalization disorder, which involves an ongoing feelings of detachment from your actions, feelings, thoughts, and sensations, as if you were watching a movie. Sometimes other people and things may feel like people and things in the world around them are not real. You can experience depersonalization or derealization or both in this category. And the average onset is age 16, although episodes can happen before that. But typically, people don't really start experiencing episodes after the age of 20. So if they haven't started by 20, they're not likely to be a thing. Which I thought was interesting because I know that schizophrenia onset, it's really common to start after age 20.
Yeah.
And then we have DID, which is formerly known as multiple personality disorder, and it's characterized by alternating between multiple identities. People may feel like one or more voices are trying to take control in their head, and they often have unique names, characteristics, mannerisms, and voices. People with DID experience gaps in memory of everyday events, personal information, and the traumas that caused their personalities to split in the first place. And again, women are more likely to be diagnosed, as it's more common that they present with acute dissociative symptoms. The way men are socialized, they're more likely to deny symptoms and trauma histories, and they're more likely to exhibit more violent behavior rather than amnesia or fugue states. So it can lead to, like, false negative diagnoses just because it shows up differently.
Yeah.
Well, you know, interestingly, there's a select group of people who identify as plural, and it's like they have multiple identities inside of them, but it's integrated more in a way where they don't experience the amnesia that comes with it.
Oh.
And I've had clients who have plural identities, and they have described instances of their different identities kind of, like, interacting with one another. And a lot of people who are gender fluid or trans, or a lot of people who are plural identify as gender fluid or trans because they have multiple identities inside of them that hold different genders. Yeah. So I'd encourage people to look into, like, plurality as well, because it was not something that I was familiar with. And it is a little bit different than DID because of, I guess, the more integrated part of it, integrated part of the identities versus, like, the amnesia that comes with not being able to recall when different identities are, like, fronting, I guess. Yeah, I was thinking about that. And then I was also thinking about this Reply All episode that I watched, which is a podcast from Gimlet. I listened to it several years ago, and it was about this thing called tulpas, which is, like, people who have these voices in their heads, which I also found, like, really, like, interesting. They're kind of like imaginary friends, but, like, in adults. So people are curious. They'll look those things up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
Yeah. DID is really wild, too, because, like, there's... Well, for a long time, some psychologists were like, it's not real.
Yeah,
Which I think largely has to do with the way that we just simply don't believe women when they're presenting with things.
There's a great show, actually, on Netflix that has Toni Collette in it.
Oh, I love that show! United States of Tara.
Yes, United States of Tara, mm-hmm. which, yeah, she has DID. And that's actually one of the, okay representations of DID in the media. Yeah, so check it out.
They canceled it.
Yep, I really classic. Enjoyed it. I mean, Netflix always cancels their good shows and, you know, continues to make, 100 Kissing Booth movies.
What is up with that, bro?
They care more about quantity than quality, is what is up with that.
Yes. And, I think they would probably consider Kissing Booth to be less controversial, so it's probably easier to maintain, viewership.
Yeah, I mean, they canceled Hasan Minhaj's show, too.
Did they?
Yeah, because he was always covering controversial subjects, so they probably were getting shit from, China, Saudi Arabian government, U.S. government. They're probably getting a lot of pressure to cancel his show, and so they did. Hopefully someone else picks up his stuff, but...
What the fuck? That's DID. Just wanted to expand on that a little bit, because I didn't want to just say she's talking about having DID... and leave it there, because it's complex and, doesn't necessarily connotate someone who has violent tendencies or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I would probably say that most of the time that's not the case at all.
Yeah. I mean, similarly with people who have schizophrenia, I think oftentimes they're characterized to be violent when that's a really small number of people.
Yep. Yeah, so back to conspiracy theory. It's likely that, her story really, is, the birthplace of the QAnon people and the satanic panic people. Mm-hmm. I could see it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there were people that were trying to say that Jonestown was actually a mass mind control experiment conducted by the CIA. And this was said by Joseph Hollinger, who is a former aide to the congressman Leo Ryan. And so in 1979, he was like, this is the CIA's doing.
I mean, we did talk about in the last episode how, Jim Jones was using tactics that were used in MKUltra.
100%.
So, I see where people are connecting the two things.
Yeah.
Obviously... I mean, there's always a possibility, but I don't know. I feel like, I feel like it was just Jim Jones being a fucker.
Just being Jim.
Yeah.
Yeah. They also published this in a newspaper column claiming that the CIA was involved in the Jonestown Massacre. And
not out of the realm of possibility, just another way for them to commit genocide against Black Americans.
That's true.
And the MK Ultra was... doing similar shit.
That's true. I mean, that's the thing, right? MK Ultra feels like a conspiracy and it was a real thing. So how do you know?
Yeah.
What's really happening out here?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah. I see how people are making those ties.
Yeah.
As conjecture.
Yeah. And the same newspaper guy, Jack Anderson, speculated that the deputy chief of mission of the U.S. Embassy to Guyana, Richard Dwyer, had ties to the CIA.
Mm.
And in 1918, an investigation by the U.S. House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, they did an investigation. They found no evidence of CIA activity in Jonestown, which, who knows?
Yep.
Truly, who knows? And, echoes of this kind of, I don't know, this paranoia that and, distrust of the state, the way that it has influenced culture to this day. I was reading that, some people are saying that MKUltra is still active and controlling celebrities.
Wow.
There are people who said after the shooting in Uvalde, some people on social media were, MK Ultra is accountable for the gunman's violence. So it's just wild. the way that this like weaves through all the things.
It's like a ways for people to make meaning out of really fucked up events like Jonestown.
Yes.
But I mean, you know, we explain why Jonestown happened and it has explanations that are not rooted in conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
That I think it's just hard for people to digest the realness, like that, oh, this person totally had the capacity without being a part of a mind control experiment to walk into a school and shoot a bunch of children.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. I feel like the way we're socialized, we're really prone to be like, oh, this entity is bad. Therefore, they're responsible for like X, Y, and Z. You know how we talk about like serial killers not being inherently born in a particular, like it's not as simple as being like this person was a bad person who did bad things and we just need to be careful for evil people. It feels like the same line of logic that's like the CIA is just evil and bad and therefore all of these things that happen are somehow connected to them as if, you know, this kind of pattern isn't intrinsic to just like the white supremacist origin of the United States, you know, like as if we don't socialize people to embrace white supremacy and dynamics of power and control.
Yeah.
And like reward it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think, yeah, to your point, I think it's easier for people to make that A plus B equals C connection rather than acknowledge the conditions that allow for it.
Yeah, because then the A plus B equals C means, okay, well, if we like take down MK Ultra, then none of this will ever happen again.
Right, right, right.
Whereas if you have to sit with the fact that these events are results of the social conditions we live in, then you also have to sit with the fact that it takes a lot more complicated solutions and a lot more complex solutions and a really just like a shift of our society as a whole, which is really hard for your brain to imagine what could that even look like, you know? So it's easier to just be like, oh, well, that's the bad guy. So let's just like blame it on the MK Ultra. Because if we blame it on white supremacy and patriarchy, who are we blaming?
Right. And what's my role in it?
Yeah.
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 Or what's my own capacity for that kind of violence?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or is it like, you know?
Yeah. It makes you like, it distances you from it if you're like, oh, it's MK Ultra. Whereas if you are to admit that it's like part of white supremacy culture, then it's much closer to you. And then you do have to kind of interrogate like how you might be reinforcing some of those values or ignoring some of those impacts.
Yeah, I feel like it's the same, like, I feel like it's the same attitude that allowed people like Gary Ridgway and Ted Bundy and all these like fucking serial killers, like allowed for them to just keep going. And like the amount of times that people said that's the person and they're just unwilling to believe that that was the person because they probably saw this man and was like, no, that's like my neighbor. That's like my coworker. That's like my uncle. That's like my brother, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so this brings me to an academic article about conspiracy theories. There's a lot to the psychology of the conspiracy theories, and I'm not going to go all the directions, but I did find this article written in the Australasian Journal of Psychiatry. It's a peer-reviewed journal from scholars from both Australia and New Zealand.
Okay.
And I'm just going to read snippets that I found. So this is an article about how conspiracy theories are conceptualized via a spectrum of trust versus distrust. And they say humans are not born to trust unreservedly. In fact, epistemic vigilance was suggested to denote a natural tendency to be cautious and guard against misinformation as a way of protecting oneself and thereby gaining an evolutionary advantage in a world that is characterized by hostility from others more than benevolence, which...
That makes sense.
Does make sense. And I think I would add that I don't think we are inherently mostly hostile. I think colonization and imperialism has shifted the way that we relate to one another.
Yeah.
So they say, in other words, humans may be quote-unquote primed to be mistrustful to ensure survival. It is only through secure attachment, sensitive caring, attuned communication, and benign social context that epistemic trust can develop so that humans are able to appraise information and knowledge as accurate, reliable, and useful.
Okay.
Because, like, this made me think a lot about developmental trauma and how the balance of mistrust and trust is, like, really unequal when you have developmental trauma, because it's, like, really hard to maintain and regain trust when your primary caregivers, who are supposed to inherently be trustworthy, betray you or hurt you. And, you know, I was thinking about the way we're able to set healthy boundaries and develop secure attachment to self and others.
Oh, yes. I recently was invited to go on another podcast. Yeah, it's the All Humans Are Human podcast / the Annie Allman Show, which I recently went on. It's episode 136, and I talked about the creation of secure attachment to self and others. And we do talk a little bit about how, like, serial killers and stuff are related to that. So,
of course,
check it out. We'll put similar, it- but, you know, different vibe.
Yes, we'll put it in the info.
Yeah.
And I also, when they talk about benign social context, that also stood out to me, because I think that benign social context is a privilege afforded to people closest to the dominating class, you know? And then I was thinking about, like, wow, this is why CBT, for example, has its limitations. Like, not only is it considered an evidence-based practice for predominantly, like, white, straight, cis men and women, I feel like people get gaslighted into being, like, into thinking that what they have, what they're concerned about, isn't a real concern. But like, if you're like a person from a marginalized community who has regularly received, like, harm via, you know, the intersections of race, class, gender, it's not unreasonable for you to be cautious that that's going to come up again.
Yeah.
Because it has regularly shown itself
as a threat. For sure.
CBT stands for cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's, like, one of the, like, top, quote unquote, like, interventions. Like, insurance is most likely to pay for CBT.
Yeah. Or CBT, like, stuff. And it pretty much says that, like, if you change your thoughts, you can change your behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, I think, I mean,
which is, that's not untrue.
Yeah. It's just incomplete.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It is incomplete.
And it's, like, not not for everything.
Yeah.
I feel like they just throw CBT at everything.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't CBT your way out of oppression, you know?
No.
Like, bro, what the fuck?
No.
I mean, you can't therapy your way out of oppression, but you certainly can't CBT your way out of oppression.
Definitely not.
And the impacts of that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, moving on. This article then says, an optimal balance between epistemic vigilance and epistemic trust is one of the hallmarks of healthy development. If this balance is achieved and maintained, the person is unlikely to become too naive and therefore more easily exploited, or too mistrustful or even paranoid and therefore unable to benefit from genuine, enriching human connection. The article goes on to say, naivete and paranoia are the extreme consequences of an imbalance between epistemic vigilance and epistemic trust, with many combinations of trust and mistrust existing between these extremes. Whether trust or mistrust predominates any given situation depends on the circumstances, developmental factors, and personal experience. While it's reasonable and advantageous to be predominantly mistrustful in certain situations, e.g. when interacting with an aggressive salesperson, it is equally reasonable and advantageous to be predominantly trustful in others, e.g. in a long-term relationship with a partner who has passed many quote-unquote tests of trustworthiness and loyalty. This ability to be flexible and shift between trust and mistrust when needed is absent in people with quote-unquote chronic epistemic mistrust, which is usually associated with personality disturbance, which I imagine they're talking about personality disorders, which we've talked about as personality structures as a response to trauma.
Yeah.
See the Catherine episode.
Yeah.
A tendency to relate with to others with mistrust and rigidly adhere to certain beliefs also characterizes many people with conspiracy beliefs. So, let's get into the conspiracy part.
Yeah.
While most authors use the term conspiracy beliefs and conspiracy theories interchangeably, some make a distinction between the two. Conspiracy beliefs is the term preferred in this article because conspiracy theories ultimately refer to one or more beliefs. Furthermore, the term conspiracy theories is often misused, especially when the aim is to disqualify the opponents on the grounds that they espouse such theories and that these theories are inherently wrong.
Yeah, like, people are like, aliens is a conspiracy theory, when obviously it's not. See all of our episodes about aliens. And all the government, you know, trials that they're doing and hearings they're doing right now about it.
I mean, sometimes it's a conspiracy theory.
Sometimes it's a conspiracy theory, but, you know.
We still don't have real proof.
Hey, I tend to disagree with that.
That's true.
See the episode about cattle mutilations.
That's true. What happened to them?
Yeah.
Also, Stefan. Shout outs to Stefan. Yeah, we have one, like, full episode about a UFO
experience. Encounter.
Yeah. It's called Okay, Yankee Boys, I'll Help You.
Yeah.
And it's compelling. I was like, wow, what is this but?
Yeah.
A UFO from another place.
Yeah.
Because the technology is wild as fuck.
Yeah.
Anyways.
There's also a documentary series called UFO that came out last year. Goes through all of the evidence of UFO in history.
Yeah. I saw that. Did I see that? Or is he another one? I don't know. There's another one that was pretty compelling too. That was like, wow. Okay. Whatever.
Anyways.
They're probably out here.
They are. They're probably, maybe they're listening to a podcast. Hello.
So, several components are common to most definitions of conspiracy beliefs and theories, as follows. 1. Conspiracy beliefs purport to provide a causal explanation. X is caused by Y, with an underlying and often unapparent causal pattern. Which is what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
2. The causal explanation assumes a plan developed in secrecy, hence the notions of a plot and conspiracy, due to their presumed secrecy and the associated imperviousness to any testing of their veracity. It may be difficult to either prove or disprove the accuracy of many conspiracy beliefs, which contributes to their persistence. Mm-hmm. Which reminds me a lot of, like, what we talked about with urban legends and how urban legends thrive because we can't really find the origin.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, where'd it come from?
Yeah.
3. More than one person is involved in the underlying activities because the very notion of conspiracy rules out actions of a single person. Certain powerful groups are usually presumed to take part in conspiracies. 4. There's usually an assumption of malevolent intentions by the conspirators, with the goal of causing harm or at least disruption. Not all conspiracy beliefs are false in the sense that some conspiracies subsequently turn out to be true. E.g., a notion that the CIA financed covertly or indirectly some modern artists to gain advantage during the Cold War, or
MKUltra.
However, the focus in this article is on the conspiracy beliefs that are cross-sectionally unfounded to most people. The spectrum of mistrust-related phenomena is characterized with the degree of mistrust increasing from healthy doubt and skepticism all the way out to persecutory delusions, which they have a table on here that I'm going to try to convey. Healthy doubt and skepticism is said to be an acceptance of information or assumption if it can be proven to be correct, foundation of much of the human knowledge and basis of all scientific inquiries, accountability of institutions in a democracy, and the requirement to prove guilt in the court of law are influenced by a healthy doubt and skepticism, as described by this, by these psychiatry people, which, you know, take that as you're going to take that. And then they move forward to conspiracy sympathy, which is the tendency to have an understanding for people's conspiracy beliefs and even to validate them without agreeing about their beliefs. You know, I don't believe in that, but I can see how you do and I respect your beliefs.
Yeah.
Then there's excessive doubt and skepticism, suspiciousness,
They say interference as a result of doubt and skepticism outweighs the benefit, general tendency to be mistrustful, and a feature of paranoid personality disorder. And then they move on to conspiracy belief, which is an unfounded, fixed belief held with strong conviction about harm, usually inflicted by powerful groups on the community or other group of people, with preserved insight that belief differs from the belief that most people have about the same matter, and with reasons for having the belief not necessarily being implausible. So, I feel like this is where a lot of the CIA conspiracy theories kind of live.
Yeah.
Because it is not implausible that the CIA does drastically horrific and outlandish things to people in secret.
Yeah.
And just gets away with it.
Yeah.
Like, that is not implausible. Yeah. And then the last one they list is conspiracy mentality, general conspiracy mindset, conspiracy worldview, persecutory delusion. So this is like beyond like a singular belief and more like this is how you live your life. This is your worldview. Tendency to espouse multiple conspiracy beliefs, regardless of whether or not they are related, and even when they are mutually incompatible. False and fixed belief held with strong conviction about being singled out for harm by one or more persons, with little or no insight that the belief differs from the belief that most people have about the same matter, and with reasons for having the belief usually being implausible. This reminds me a lot. I listened to this podcast. I don't remember what it's called, but it's a podcast about ordinary people becoming radicalized and doing wild shit. And they covered this lady who ended up like becoming the head of some like hyper religious Christian cult. And it like included like reptilian shit, and like she was like foraging for these like crystals that she insisted were like gonna fend off these reptilian alien people, and Jesus and God were somewhere like weaved in there. It's wild. But like there were so many times where there would be contradictions, like she would predict a thing and it wouldn't happen, and she'd find a way to explain away why it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And there was just really no telling her to go any other way.
Yeah.
So this article goes on and says, while the threat or harm in conspiracy beliefs usually comes from a powerful, mistrusted group and relates to the community or another group of people, the threat or harm in persecutory delusions originates from one or more individuals, and the target is usually the person with the delusions, who then feels singled out. People with conspiracy beliefs usually share their belief with others and have a need for the beliefs to be validated, especially by a disempowered, silent minority. It reminds me a lot of Trumpy QAnon people who I think are mostly middle class / like poor white people who keep on saying like we're oppressed. Feels very tied in with that.
Yeah.
This search or need for quote-unquote like-minded people generally does not characterize individuals with persecutory delusions, with a notable exception of those with folie à deux. Back to shared psychosis.
Slenderman episode.
Yeah. Which nobody cares about.
Yeah.
People with conspiracy beliefs know that they are a minority, whereas those with persecutory delusions are either unaware that others do not have the same or similar beliefs, or are indifferent about the beliefs of other people.
Okay.
Depending on the type of conspiracy beliefs, reasons for having them may be plausible, especially in the setting of a predominant uncertainty in the society or when official accounts have many obvious inconsistencies. In contrast, reasons, if any, given in support of delusional beliefs tend to be implausible. In clinical practice, the distinction between conspiracy beliefs and persecutory delusions is not always clear-cut. An evolution from non-delusional conspiracy belief to a delusion of persecution by conspirators is possible, suggesting that a boundary between non-psychosis and psychosis might be fluid longitudinally, if not cross-sectionally. Finally, conspiracy beliefs may appear on a continuum of plausibility, from those that are more plausible, relatively common in the general population, and very unlikely to be associated with mental illness, to those that are highly implausible, relatively rare in the general population, and suggestive of a mental disturbance such as psychosis. So this is like, you know, a psychiatric journal, so the language is highly pathologizing mm-hmm. and incomplete around like social conditions, right? Mm-hmm. They're not really talking about that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're just like noting what they've found in a really like, it feels very individual to
me.
But it gave me a lot of information around, I don't know, to help me wrap my head around like conspiracy theories and like how people form them, why they form them, who forms them, and then like the different like point, like the spectrum.
Yeah.
That they can exist on.
Yep. Yeah. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah. And how a lot of these are like overlapped with like the pathologizing of, you know, magical thinking.
And,
schizophrenia and what have you.
All of those things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and also, you know, when they were talking about when explanations are given that are like inconsistent. And I'm like, the government does shit like that all the time. So it really does create an environment of uncertainty, especially over the past few years with the pandemic. People are really, government's really been fucking with people's heads so much. So it makes sense that like people's response to it are these like really intense and implausible conspiracy theories because there's such a like culture of uncertainty that has been developed by the government. Giving so much mixed messaging. And they oftentimes do that, so.
Yeah, they do. They also talked about how the internet just makes it a lot easier to find the like-minded people that you want to find.
Yeah, because confirmation bias. You just search for things to confirm what you believe in, and it's really easy to do that with the internet.
Yes, you know? Yes. Yeah, so that's a bit on conspiracy. I'm going to keep talking. this is just how it worked out this time around. So I'm sorry if you're tired of listening to me, but it's going to be a little longer. So the results of MKUltra obviously like expanded way beyond the experiments themselves. And in reality, we will like never really know all of the ways it has permeated so many people's lives and like what families inherited that shit. But another unintended consequence of MKUltra is that they introduced LSD to the public. And so LSD was really instrumental in developing the counterculture in the 60s. And like the people who volunteered in these experiments, like at the universities, a lot of them did find it very pleasurable. And then they told their buddies about it. Some of those people included Ken Kesey, who is the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He also was known for his like hippy dippy cross country school bus trip. Yeah. Which
I read a book about that.
Did you?
What is the book? Ken Kesey and his band of merry pranksters was what they called. And there's a book, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test is the book. Written by this journalist who was with them during this trip. It's a wild book.
I bet.
Yeah, just wild.
I found an interview from Terry Gross, who does Fresh Air, but like a long time ago, which was interesting.
Yeah.
She's really been out here. But yeah, she was talking to him. He's on another planet.
Yeah, he actually, that story is wild, but then at a certain point, he was in prison and he got his friends to send him LSD in prison, and then he did trips in prison, but you know he wanted to do that, so
a lot of this is just about choice.
Choice and race,
that too. Also, another one of those people is Robert Hunter, who is the lyricist for the Grateful Dead. And then he, you know, this article called him a great purveyor of LSD culture. Another like well-known person was Allen Ginsberg, who is a poet who was also very into LSD and told his buddies about it.
Yeah.
And him and his friends are really, like, responsible for starting the Beatnik movement. He was a student at Columbia University in the 1940s, and he wrote a lot about opposing militarism, economic materialism, sexual repression, and then he embodied various aspects of this counterculture with his views on drug, sex, multiculturalism, hostility to bureaucracy, and the openness to Eastern religions, Wikipedia says.
Classic.
Yes. Always. These men always really love the Eastern religions.
Yeah.
Okay. He's best known for his poem Howl, in which he denounced what he saw, the destructive forces of capitalism and conformity in the United States. And there was like a whole thing where they, where the SF police and US Customs seized Howl, his book, in 1956. They seized it, and then it attracted a lot of publicity in 1957 when it became subject of an obscenity trial because it described like gay sex at a time where sodomy laws made that illegal, which kind of like overlaps with the lavender scare stuff we shared in the last one.
Yeah.
But Judge Clayton W. Horn ruled that Howl was not obscene, saying, would there be any freedom of press or speech if one must reduce his vocabulary to vapid, innocuous euphemisms? Which, you know, speaks to his privilege as a white man. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, this really just worked out for him.
Yeah.
Not that that wasn't traumatic to have to, you know. Many things can be true at the same time. Mm-hmm. LSD being, like, available to the public also, like, created some subgroups of people. So there was, like, camps of people who, like, were all about seeking self-awareness. I'm thinking about the guy who was, like, tune in to...
Turn on, tune in, drop out.
Which I took a class on theories of personality and learned a lot about how it was just a bunch of white people who became extremely like egotistical, just spending their whole, all their time just like tripping out and trying to find themselves.
Yeah.
During a time where there's so much fucking shit happening.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah.
You mean tune out?
Yeah.
Tune out, out.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was subgroups that were all about being like, that embodied expressivity. And then also a group of people who were trying to understand life through use of drugs. So there was like all of these subgroups in the counterculture that were super prominent and shaped like the summer of love time in the 1960s. It influenced music, but it also influenced some cults and new religions. In this Medium article by Neurotech at Berkeley. So, like, over the course of 35 years, doctors, psychiatrists, and government and military officials administered drugs like LSD to unsuspecting civilians in order to plant messages in their brain, carry out extreme behaviors, and in some cases kill on specific cues. This ties in specifically to one aspect of the definition of cults, inducing powerful subjective experiences in order to open the mind to extreme beliefs. So it's like interesting. They're like, I want to use this for mind control, but they're using something that's like designed to be expansive, right? It's like the opposite.
Yeah.
It's no surprise, coincidentally, that the rise of cults and the new religious movements in the 1960s accompanied the rise of psychedelics. In the midst of the counterculture and the Summer of Love in San Francisco, Charles Manson, who would later become the murderous cult leader of the Manson family, would move drugs and distribute LSD at gatherings, which gained him a number of followers. In Australia, around the same time, Anne Hamilton Byrne, a yoga instructor and wealthy suburbanite, these white lady yoga instructors. What's up with that? operated a new age cult in secrecy for over two decades. She claimed she was a reincarnation of Jesus Christ and preached a hodgepodge of the world religions and miscellaneous esoterica, including UFOs. A disciple psychiatrist, Howard Whitaker, helped her take over a private psychiatric hospital in Kew, where he and other members recruited patients to join the cult and administered LSD to cult members.
Oh my goodness.
LSD played a pivotal role in the cult, in both recruitment and maintenance.
Jesus.
Yes. And also, there's some, like, rumors about how some people believe that Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, was subject to MKUltra experiments during his time at Harvard.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of unintended consequences.
Yeah. Unintended consequences.
Yeah. Like, what happens when you, like, mix all of these things together?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some fucked up shit.
Yeah.
Clearly.
So, that's what I got.
Well, you know, this was all happening at a time where LSD was new and not illegal. So, how did it get to a point where, you know, it was illegal? Clearly, all of this contributed to it.
Interestingly, controversy around LSD began in the early 1960s when people like Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert began conducting their own experiments at Harvard, which were like not very professional. But I just find that interesting because I'm like, you think that their experiments weren't professional and you think what MKUltra was.
Yeah, what the fuck?
Like, hello. But they received heavy criticism for the experiments. And he stated they did not believe that the experiences were beneficial to the participants.
But so, the CIA did a great job.
Right. The hypocrisy is wild. It's like, oh, we're allowed to do that. I mean, we talked about this. The CIA is heavily hypocritical. They're like, the Nazis are bad, but
we're gonna hire them. But we're taking notes.
Right. Anyways, after they were both like dismissed from Harvard because of this, and then Turn On, Tune In, Drop Out was happening, and there was like a lot of negative publicity. And then, like, basically in 1961, which was before all this was happening, the US signed and ratified the United Nations Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs, which regulated cannabis, opium, and cocaine, but not the classic psychedelics. There was an interview later on in the late 60s when, like, the Controlled Substances Act was being written, and this was during Nixon administration. And one of Nixon's top advisors, John Ehrlichman, admitted that the Nixon administration's motive for starting the entire drug war was both racist and culturist, quoting, what's his name? John Ehrlichman. He says, "You want to know what the war on drugs was really about? The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana, the blacks, quote, with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did." So.
Oh my god.
They fucking knew that they were using, like, the war on drugs as a way to basically just incarcerate people who were speaking out. So then in 1970... the Controlled Substances Act, which exists to this day, was created, and it made psychedelics Schedule I drugs, categorizing them as having no currently accepted medical use. And this effectively shut down research into LSD until the late 90s, when public interest in it was kind of reignited. And basically, the Controlled Substances Act resulted in severe punishments for the use, possession, and distribution of psychedelics, with sentences similar to those of violent crimes, which, again, like, is so hypocritical, because the harm that MKUltra, like, committed upon, like, probably thousands and thousands of people, and probably the impacts of it are still felt today, and we don't even know what those impacts are, and no one faced any consequences for that. Whereas the Controlled Substances Act was, like, you know, became a thing, and then tons of individuals who were, like, using this probably not in a harmful way were being incarcerated and, like, traumatized through incarceration. The hypocrisy is really wild and aggravating.
I hate it here.
It also resulted in research on these, like, substances becoming very expensive, so most people just stopped doing it. And then in 1971, the UN Convention on Psychotropic Drugs was updated, and the US exported its, like, ideology globally, which is why, you know, drug laws are so similar worldwide. It's because the Controlled Substances Act was basically taken to the UN and then turned into the UN Convention on Psychotropic Drugs, and all of these different countries signed it. LSD is still currently Schedule I on the Controlled Substances Act, which is the most heavily criminalized category of drugs. Schedule I drugs are considered to have high potential for abuse and no currently accepted medical use. Though when it comes to LSD, as we talked about in the previous episode, there's literally no toxicity level for it. There's significant evidence that, contrary to both of those facts, even though, like, you know, it's a both and of, like, LSD is a substance that can be really used to torture and abuse individuals. And at the same time, there's drugs that are, like, way more harmful than LSD that are scheduled lower or not scheduled at all. For example, alcohol, you know. So that like brings me to kind of the last thing I'm going to talk about today, which is kind of the resurgence of like psychedelic research in the past sort of like 10 years, 20 years that maybe a lot of people have heard of, because especially in the past few years, it's been in the media a lot. So currently there's a lot of research being done in more ethical ways, obviously, on the therapeutic potential of psychedelics, like mostly MDMA, ketamine, and psilocybin are kind of at the forefront of that. And in 2019, Denver became the first city in the U.S. to decriminalize psilocybin mushrooms. And Oakland, Santa Cruz, Seattle, and four cities in Massachusetts have also done the same. Oregon actually decriminalized psilocybin and legalized its use in psychotherapy in 2020. And ayahuasca, mescaline, and psychedelic mushrooms were decriminalized in Washington, D.C. last year. However, disproportionate criminalization still remains. And the ACLU found in a 2020 study that in every state that has legalized or decriminalized marijuana possession, Black people are still more likely to be arrested for possession than white people. Mm-hmm. The stigma attached to Black drug users under the war on drugs also mean that white people have the privilege of publicizing psychedelic use, as is an example from the 60s, with lesser consequences than minorities, and therefore some participants may feel excluded from these experiences. Sonia Faber, who's a clinical psychologist who's written about psychedelic-assisted therapy, states, for Black people, the punishment for using illicit substances is so much higher. So culturally, we've been told to stay far away from those things because you don't get a second chance if you get in trouble with drugs. Mm-hmm. And psychedelics are still illegal under federal law, even if these like states and cities have, you know, changed their stance on it. Monica T. Williams and like Dana Strauss, who I mentioned earlier, did a study in 2018 kind of looking at who were the participants of the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy studies that have been happening more recently. Mm-hmm. And they found that across 18 trials, 82% of the participants were white, while just 2.5% were Black. A lack of inclusion by an overwhelmingly white field of researchers that goes directly against federally mandated efforts to report and recruit diverse samples in clinical trials. Monica Williams states in a 2019 interview about talking about recruitment challenges. So this is what I was mentioning way at the beginning of the episode. She states, because of the criminalization of all of these substances and the fallout from the war on drugs, African Americans face a lot of danger when it comes to using drugs or even talking about them in a way that isn't true for white people. Black people have to be a lot more careful, and particularly those of us, for example, who are clinicians and are licensed. She also talks about the long history of medical racism that contributes to Black hesitancy to get involved in psychedelic trials. Mm-hmm. Quoting Dana Strauss, often, just in trying to access healthcare, Black people are routinely met with bias, and these same biases exist in mental health care. In 2021, a study led by Williams found that people of color in North America report improvements in racial trauma and mental health symptoms following psychedelic experiences, and that trauma-related symptoms linked to racist acts were lowered in the 30 days after an experience with psilocybin, LSD, or MDMA. So there's a potential for healing that these substances can bring to communities of color, but there's like such a loaded history of abuse that's tied to them, as we've talked about today, spent a lot of time talking about today. Mm-hmm. So that really makes it difficult to even recruit people to participate in the studies because of the amount of fear and mistrust they have, mm-hmm. like towards the medical system in general. A psychiatric nurse practitioner and co-founder of Mind Lumen, Kwasi Adusa, says he hopes there will be alternative ways of offering therapy to those who need it most. Quoting him, no matter how amazing these tools such as MDMA are, if we don't deal with the issues of the system itself, all we do is widen health disparities. For those who do want to want access to psychedelics, getting their way into clinical models is going to be really difficult unless you're designing for it. If you can design for the people who are the least able to access these services, you offer a system that's accessible for literally everybody. So there's people that are like trying to change this, which mm-hmm. is very cool. Psychedelic research, like most Western science and medicine, has historically been and continues to be an extremely white-dominated field. In addition to what I just talked about, which is like ethical concerns around excluding certain groups of people from research, it also means that the treatments may not be as safe, effective, or accessible for those same groups of people. This article, which kind of talks about, you know, the history of psychedelic research and how it connects back to right now, says that it's imperative to find a way for the field to become inclusive. It's imperative that the field is inclusive of historically excluded and exploited groups, particularly Black and Indigenous communities. First and foremost, inclusivity means genuine, non-tokenized inclusion of Black, Indigenous, and people of color across all levels of research processes, from participants to principal investigators. Also means treating all participants and experts in accordance with the principles outlined in the Belmont Report, with basic trust and respect, as well as publishing on culturally inclusive topics. Another important part of inclusivity involves divesting our institutions and ourselves of Eurocentric worldviews that value Western philosophies above all other ways of knowing and healing. This piece is fundamental to honoring Indigenous communities through reciprocity. Finally, it's critical that the current and future psychedelic researchers, especially white researchers, recognize and take responsibility to address the research abuses perpetrated against Black and Indigenous peoples and their ongoing impacts on these communities. So this is from an article that is called "The CIA Exploited Incarcerated Black Americans in Race for Mind Control Agent." Published in July 2021. And yeah, it's related to the research paper I mentioned earlier on. So all of that being said, it's fucked up, but there's ways for it to not be fucked up anymore. If people are to, you know, admit to the like very racist and harmful origins of this research and try to center like the healing of historically marginalized and traumatized groups of people and afford them easy access to these potentially really amazing forms of treatment.
Yeah. I'm also just thinking about how like psychedelics have been like gentrified to like these plants, like psilocybin and
ayahuasca,
peyote, ayahuasca,
mescaline, those,
yeah, all of those things are like spiritually significant to different communities, and then now they've been one criminalized and then commodified for white people. Like white people go all the time for their ayahuasca journeys.
Oh yeah, totally. They have been. It's been very commercialized, and I mean, there's a lot of actually literature in the past few years that's like kind of about the commercialization and how capitalism is like, you know, impacting the field of psychedelic research because it's a predominantly white dominated field. So of course it would.
Right.
And the exclusion of like Indigenous people from this is especially fucked up because their practices were criminalized in a way that they weren't able to engage in their spiritual practices with these plant medicines anymore. And then now, what, like, white people are able to use them in clinical settings? Like, yeah. So.
Is that...
That's all I have.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think that's it.
That's it for MK Ultra.
Well, we're going to follow up with some more info, but...
Yeah, I mean, clearly there's a lot of stuff here that people can dig in on more. If they're interested, like, we definitely touched on a lot of different things. And if people are curious, for example, about what is the research that's happening right now, I encourage you to take a look at that. One really cool organization that centers Indigenous and people of color is the Chacruna Institute. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage you to check out their work. I would also encourage you to read the research of the people I mentioned, Dana Strauss, Monica T. Williams. Yeah.
Awesome.
So there's that. Hope you enjoyed. Hope you learned a lot about the horrific history,
the United States.
A little dot on the long timeline of fuckery that is the United States.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Take care of yourselves.
And yeah, we'll catch you next time.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening and for supporting us. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Unpacking the Eerie, on Twitter at Unpack the Eerie, and on our website at www.unpackingtheeerie.com.
Yes, and special thanks to all of you who subscribe to our Patreon. As we've mentioned before, we do all the research for this, we edit, and we don't have any sponsorships or ads. So Patreon support is super helpful in just keeping this project sustainable, keeping the Buzzsprout subscription going, paying for the website, all the stuff. So thank you so much.
Sari, Liz, Clifton,
Jill, Victoria, and Lindsay,
Lauren, Vivian, Valerie,
Micheline, Montana, Katrina,
Raina, Allie, Jake,
Drithi, Daphne, and Katie,
Vern, Meredith H, and Vince,
to April, Aaron, and Ellen,
and to Brittany, Alyssa, and Meredith R.
Yay, thank you so much.
Thank you.